Welcome. Today is Thursday, August 11th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. paints a bleak portrait of global religious freedom. Russia agrees to a three-hour humanitarian ceasefire in Syria. A new HBO documentary takes on a taboo subject.
Abortion wasn't an option for me because it's not the choice for me.
Also ahead, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton trade attacks over ongoing controversies. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, we're glad you could join us. The United States is painting a bleak portrait of religious freedom around the world. A new report is particularly condemning some Islamic countries that have adopted harsh laws. State Department Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, David Saperstein, talked about it with VOA.
One quarter of all the countries in the world have some form of anti-blasphemy law. One out of ten punish people for apostasy. So this is a serious problem because often these have death penalties that are attached to them or very severe punishments. And we see this in countries all across the globe. The very nature of all these laws punishes people for expressing their core beliefs when those core beliefs turn out to be offensive to whomever has political power in the country.
Well, the report singled out numerous countries, including Pakistan, where 40 people, many of them religious minorities, remain on death row for blasphemy.
There are many countries that have these laws but don't do anything about them. Pakistan is fairly vigorous about arresting people and holding them in jail for long periods of time and punishing them for blasphemy. They also have a number of incidents, one of the highest in the world, of where societal violence happens.
The State Department also disparaged religious freedom restrictions in China, Iran, and others, but it did say there's been gradual improvement in Vietnam, and it praised the European Union for appointing two officials to monitor anti-Semitism and combat anti-Muslim hatred. Let's turn now to a lighter topic. What's trending online today with our social media goddess, G. Abby Lee. Hi, G.
Hi, Lori.
What's going on?
So there is a trending hashtag that's gaining a lot of popularity both on Twitter and Facebook. It's the hashtag #QuitYourJobIn5Days hashtag, which people can use to describe what they're going to say when they quit their job. One of the most popular tweets using that hashtag is by a local news anchor in Arizona. Lena DeFlorias tweeted, "I am out for eternity leave." Almost 1,000 people like that tweet so far. Better than sick leave, right?
Yes. Like
another popular one is, "Can't work weekends or weekdays." Another one is a GIF of a woman shouting, "I don't need this, okay? My man has two jobs." So that hashtag would be #MyManHasTwoJobs. Another good one has a Pokemon Go reference. It goes, "One to catch them all." I guess if you want to catch them all, you have no time to work.
I guess so. What is the media reaction like?
CNN Money was one of the many media outlets that posted about it on Facebook. And one of the most popular comments reads like this. Hashtag, thank you for the opportunity. Leave on good terms if possible. Never know who you may run into in the future or when you'll need a good reference.
Very true, very true. And there were some other unusual news happening earlier.
That's right. Twitter users posted reactions to a man climbing the Trump Tower in Manhattan. A Virginia man named Steve climbed the 68-story skyscraper using suction cups. But it's unclear why he scaled the building. He did make a YouTube video about it on Monday, so that was a day before he actually took the action. A man named Tom wrote on Facebook, "They clearly need to build a wall around Trump Tower." That's all for me today. Lori, back to you.
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we're following on VOAnews.com. Europeans are bemused and dismayed by Donald Trump. fears mount of a full-scale Ukraine-Russia clash. Libya is getting more U.S. help in the fight against Islamic State. Brazilians struggle economically in the midst of the Olympic Games. And a shooting gold medalist speaks out on the U.S. gun control controversy. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues with a growing humanitarian crisis in the Syrian city of Aleppo. Russia's military says it will cease fighting for 3 hours daily to allow aid deliveries. But a UN official says at least 48 hours is really needed to get sufficient support into the city. At a news conference on Wednesday, the top commander for the coalition fighting Islamic State in Syria and Iraq was asked about the situation in Aleppo.
That fight is urban. It's densely populated. People there are suffering. And to me, in many ways, Aleppo is a model of how I don't want to fight in Mosul.
McFarland, Sean McFarland, says in a matter of weeks or a week even, the terror group's stronghold in Syria will likely be in complete control of Syrian Democratic Forces.
And I agree with the president that I am 100% certain that Daesh will be eliminated as a governing entity in Iraq and Syria.
Well, the Syrian government has reportedly sent several thousand reinforcements to mount a counterattack south of Aleppo in a bid to recapture territory taken by rebel factions in recent days. A new batch of U.S. State Department emails from Hillary Clinton's earliest days as Secretary of State shows close connections between the agency and the charitable Clinton Foundation that she founded with her husband, former President Bill Clinton. The emails, released Tuesday by Judicial Watch, a conservative watchdog group and frequent Clinton antagonist, shows exchanges of emails between her aides and officials at the foundation. Reporters grilled State Department spokeswoman Elizabeth Trudeau about the emails in a press briefing on Wednesday.
Department officials are in touch with a wide range of individuals. I'd note that former Secretary Clinton's ethics agreement did not preclude other State Department officials from having contact with Clinton Foundation staff.
Clinton has long denied that donors to the charity had special access and influence at the State Department during her tenure. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is accusing the media of distorting a comment he made Tuesday about gun rights that took many to mean he was suggesting violence against Hillary Clinton. He said Clinton would decimate the Second Amendment, which guarantees Americans the right to bear arms.
Hillary wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment. By the way, and if she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know.
The Clinton campaign called Trump's comments dangerous.
Words can have tremendous consequences. Yesterday, we witnessed the latest in a long line of casual comments from Donald Trump that cross the line. His casual cruelty to a Gold Star family, his casual suggestion that more countries should have nuclear weapons, and now his casual inciting of violence.
Well, International Edition's Sarah Williams asked Danny Hayes, associate professor of political science at George Washington University, whether American politics has ever seen anything like the inflammatory rhetoric we've been seeing in this presidential campaign.
Certainly there have been campaigns in the past that have been far more vitriolic even than the campaign that we're having now. You had campaigns in the 1800s where opponents were accusing each other of having murdered citizens and things like that. This is obviously different, and it's unusual in that Trump said something like this that was so prominent and so public and seemed to encourage violence against either Hillary Clinton or against her potential judicial nominees. It's unclear, I think, which of those he was referring to in his comments. But it's certainly in keeping with Trump's approach of trying to make headlines by making outlandish statements, and in this case, an offhand remark, and then claiming that he didn't actually say what he said or mean what he said. But I think it's pretty clear what he was saying, and I think that's part of the reason that the controversy isn't going away.
Yeah, he does have a habit of, he's been described, he walks remarks back. He sort of says, well, I didn't really mean that. But in a way, you know, some people said that what he was doing was his latest remarks about Hillary Clinton and the Second Amendment. In a way, this could be like a dog whistle, which is sort of a coded message to followers who, say, National Rifle Association members who are worried about former Secretary Clinton becoming president, that she would take, you know, the rights to own their guns away from them.
Well, I think we need to be careful not to characterize this as sort of dog whistle politics in the traditional sense. Dog whistle politics often means making, as you noted, coded remarks, but this wasn't really even coded. I think the concern about this remark is that it seemed to encourage violence and in a not particularly subtle way. He wasn't making an oblique appeal to ethnocentrism or other things that are often the centerpiece of those kinds of dog whistle appeals. I actually think this was more overt than that. And so I think that's, again, part of the reason that it has caused even a lot of Republicans, people who have supported him, to criticize what he said, because I think it's largely seen appropriately as outside the bounds of appropriate politics.
He made these latest remarks soon after he got into another controversy recently with the father of a Muslim American soldier who was killed in Iraq. At the moment, we're just in August, and we have until November. But, you know, this is going on, and there are some people, particularly some Republicans, very concerned about Trump's candidacy and also how this could impact other candidates that are, what they say, lower down on the ballot, those running for the Senate or the Congress.
Yeah, and I think that's a legitimate concern. To the extent that Trump becomes representative of the Republican Party, I think there are some Republicans themselves that are obviously uncomfortable with him and might be somewhat more reticent to support other Republican candidates if they believe that they would become part of a Trump Republican Party in Washington were Trump to win. I also think that part of the challenge that Trump has is that not only does he have relatively weak support among Republican elites that, you know, again, is sort of sending weaker signals to Republicans and the public about whether they should support Trump or not, but there's also doesn't seem to be a real aggressive effort to turn out Republican voters. And so what you might end up with in November is a lower Republican turnout than we might expect in a more ordinary election. That could hurt down-ballot candidates, Senate candidates, or congressional candidates who need Republican voters to turn out and cast ballots for them. If the Republican presidential nominee can't mobilize them, then they may not be there on election day to support those down-ballot candidates.
Well, turning to some other news, the U.S. Department of Justice has released a scathing report about the police department in the eastern city of Baltimore, Maryland. The head of the department's Civil Rights Division, Vanita Gupta, says investigators uncovered a pattern of constitutional rights and federal anti-discrimination law violations, with the department systemically engaging in illegal stops, searches, arrests, and the use of excessive force, particularly with minorities.
The city's African American residents and African American neighborhoods bore the brunt of this activity. Out of the data we surveyed, the police department made roughly 44% of its stops in two small, predominantly African American districts that contain only 11% of the city's population.
Baltimore Police Department Commissioner Ken Davis is vowing to take the report seriously and regain the public's trust.
We know that our citizens are outraged at some of the details included in this report, and they should be. Citizens can't be expected to respect an agency if the trust of that agency is breached.
Davis says the report is not an indictment of all Baltimore police officers, many of whom he said are offended by the report. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
The political party convention is a critical part of the American electoral process. VOA correspondents are there, reporting the latest developments.
Jim Malone, VOA News in Cleveland.
Katherine Gibson in Cleveland, VOA News.
Tune in to VOA's extensive, up-to-the-minute coverage of the U.S. presidential election.
This is VOA's International Edition. In 1973, the United States Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade gave every woman the right to have an abortion. Now in 2016, abortion remains one of the most divisive issues in America. A new HBO documentary film, which opens in select theaters this Friday, sheds new light on the issue from the women themselves.
To be honest with you, I've actually had one in the past. Actually, it was after I had her. And I'm sorry, I hate myself for doing it, you know, but there's nothing I can do to change that now, but there's something I can do for the future and hopefully to prevent, you know, other babies from, you know, the same fate that I put that one through, so.
I wasn't healthy enough. And there was nobody that was gonna help pick up those pieces for me. So I had to do what I had to do to survive. To get by.
I just look back on it and I think, well, if I had had that baby and gotten married, we would have ended up getting divorced and I would have been a single mom and I never would have moved here and met my husband and have the two kids that I have.
Well, I did have a chance to speak with Tracy Droz Tragos, the director of the film Abortion, Stories Women Tell, and asked her what was the inspiration to want to take on such a controversial topic.
It's something that's personal to me. I feel passionate about reproductive rights for myself, for my daughters, and for women, for my sisterhood of women. I think it's incredibly important if we are to, you know, advance in our careers and advance in our educations and lift ourselves out of poverty. For women not to be second-class citizens, they need to be able to make choices for themselves and their bodies. It started with a conversation about that. Two incredible executives at HBO, I'm grateful, got behind me in this project.
Were women as willing to open up as you expected them to be?
It was hard for women to talk about it, especially in Missouri, where I think there's an added layer of shame and stigma and not talking about it. It is one of the most restrictive states in the country. So in general, it's something to be whispered and not talked out loud about. So for women to be willing to come forward and share their stories on camera was a big ask. Not every woman wanted to, even if they supported the project and believed in its potential to shift the conversation and do something important. They were behind it and they were grateful that I was making the film, but they couldn't take that leap and be on camera.
It's interesting because it's a subject in the United States that is often debated by men.
Indeed. There are still many more male politicians out there, and certainly in Missouri that is the case. And it's very disheartening, especially when issues of reproductive rights and access to health care are being debated, to hear so much from male politicians. We started filming on the eve of the 72-hour waiting period in Missouri. It was about to be made law, and to hear some of what these legislators talked about, how women just needed a little more time and they were doing women a favor to give them the time that they needed to think it over, kind of like buying a car or picking out carpet samples. You know, you needed to think these things over, and really kind of out of touch with reality and the experience of real women.
Did you speak to any women that had regret about having an abortion?
Absolutely. I did speak to women who had regret. These were women who were active in, you know, what they described as the pro-life movement, and that was part of their story, was having had abortions and looking back at it and feeling like maybe that wasn't the best choice for them at that time. And the important thing about this film was kind of honoring different perspectives and not having it be an advocacy piece that only heard from, you know, one point of view. I mean, I believe ultimately that every story kind of stands on its own legs, and it's not about women making decisions for other people, but about women being able to make decisions for themselves and, you know, having that privacy and that agency.
Any of the women's stories in particular stand out?
It's hard to reduce to one or two stories, which is why I think we included so many in the film ultimately, because it really isn't just about, there aren't just good abortions and then bad abortions, or it's not just one person's story. Amy's story stands out to me because of that. She's a single mom, two kids, working as a waitress and a bartender, working many, many hours a week and just getting by. And unplanned pregnancy was not something that she could go through with. It was a choice for herself and a choice for her family. And she said, you know, I'm not just doing this for me, I'm doing this for my kids.
Were all of these women that you spoke to from Missouri?
Most of them were from Missouri, but they were often going to seek care just over state lines in Granite City, Illinois, because Illinois has fewer restrictions than Missouri. And so in order to access care, they had to cross state lines.
And so what do you think people will take away from this film?
My greatest hope is that it brings a bit more compassion back to the conversation. I mean, it certainly is one of the most divisive issues, and there's a lot of yelling, and there's a lot of, you know, damning to hell, and there's a lot of rhetoric. And when that happens, the experience of real women is often forgotten, and their voices are simply not heard. It's harder to dismiss and reject someone when they're telling you their story and they're telling you their truth and they're sharing their lives with you a full face. And really with this film, that's what I hoped to do, was to bring a bit more compassion and understanding back to the conversation. You know, I didn't necessarily think that I was going to change anyone's mind, you know, but that we would bring more compassion and maybe stop some of this political rhetoric that we've all heard enough of.
Well, we appreciate your taking the time to talk to us. Director Tracy Droz-Tragos, the film Abortion Stories Women Tell opens in theaters this week. Well, a new computer game lets players explore new galaxies, discover new life forms, fight battles, and mine for treasure. No Man's Sky has been launched for PS4 and PC. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the game was developed in a shed in Guildford, England, and has polarized players worldwide.
I've seen things. Galaxies waiting to be found.
Seeing things seems to be one of the points of the long-awaited No Man's Sky game from Hello Games in Britain. You are one of several roles, a trader, an adventurer, a warrior, and you discover new worlds and new life forms, you gain riches or fight battles in your ship. Some planets have never been discovered, others have been because there is evidence of alien life forms on them. Some of the aliens are friendly, or at least they don't want to kill you and eat you. There are planets where the temperature is several hundred degrees Celsius, others are made of ice. Game creator Sean Murray says that the unpredictability of the game and players' need to adapt is part of its lure.
When you boot up the game, you're on a planet, a planet-sized planet, you know, which itself is unique to games, but you're also probably on a different planet than anyone else. When they boot it up, everyone is on their own unique planet, and from there they start their own unique journey because of that.
The game was designed and published by Murray and Hello Games, which is a creative team of 15 people in southern England. Sean Murray says the small size of his team ensures that the computer-generated environments give players a unique experience.
So it's pretty daunting for Hello Games to know that it is tiny 15 guys working in basically a shed in Guildford, making this game that everyone's talking about. We never set out to, like, take on the big boys or anything like that, even though that seems to be happening. What we actually set out to do was make something really different, something really unique, and offer a very different experience to what you normally see in video games.
Some reviewers have criticized No Man's Sky for being at once addictive and tedious. Players get excited about a new discovery and the acquisition of treasure to trade for upgrades. The aesthetic has been widely praised, as has the soundtrack, though some reviewers found the repetitiveness of the game frustrating. But it's the lure of discovery that pulls players back into the game. Who knows what's on the next planet? Will you discover something no one has ever seen before? Will you survive? You have to play to find out. Sean Murray says that the scale of the universes his team created allows players to have a unique experience regardless of how many players are online.
So to give you an idea of the size of our universe in No Man's Sky, it's got 2^64 planets, or 18 quintillion planets, which is a huge number and it's hard to wrap your head around. So the thing I worked out was if a planet was discovered every second in the game by players, then it would take 584 billion years to discover them all.
No Man's Sky is available for both PS4 game consoles and PCs. Prices in the United States start at around $60. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of International Edition. We're glad you could join us. Find us anytime at voanews.com. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zubair El-Tayeb. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Iran's Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei and other Iranian officials have complained that the United States has not lived up to its commitments under the Iran deal in not ensuring that Iran fully benefits economically from the lifting of nuclear-related sanctions. But as Secretary of State John Kerry has said, he has personally gone out of his way to engage with banks and businesses to make clear that legitimate business with Iran is now permitted.
We have lifted the sanctions we said we would lift, and we have completely kept faith with both the black and white print as well as the spirit of this effort.
U.S. officials, including Acting Treasury Undersecretary Adam Zubin, have observed that there are reasons why certain banks and companies may be reluctant to do business with Iran.
Some are concerned about their financial transparency, the designation of Iran as a high-risk jurisdiction by FATF, the Financial Action Task Force, the world standard-setting body for anti-money laundering and counter-terrorist financing. Others are noting concerns about corruption as well as regulatory and other obstacles to conducting business in Iran. And still others cite Iran's provocative behavior outside the nuclear file, including its active support for terrorism and its ballistic missile testing.
Mr. Zubin says that while Iran pursues more business in the aftermath of the nuclear deal, it is incumbent on Iran to address such problems, to undertake meaningful reforms, and create an environment in which businesses feel secure. Additionally, Mr. Zubin makes clear, we have been and will continue to be very careful to deliver on the promises we made to Iran throughout the negotiations. That means proactively providing clear guidance about the type of commerce that is now permitted.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage. www.voanews.com/editorials.
It's 4 hours.